Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Glad you could be with me for this March 9th, 2015 edition of the Heretics Hour. I'm your host, Carolyn Yeager. George Lincoln Rockwell would be 97 years old today, but I'm not going to be talking about him. However, I was just considering whether he could live to be 97, and he was sort of a laid-back guy, and it's possible he could have done that. And wouldn't that be something? But unfortunately, his life was cut short, and not by an enemy, but by a so-called friend. Well, the Nazi Documentation Center in Munich is scheduled to open April 30th, 2015, the 70th anniversary of American troops' liberation of this city from Nazi rule. Can you imagine that Germans would consider that their city of Munich was actually liberated in 1945 by American troops? But that's the way it's presented, that's the way it's presented today, and nobody complains about it. That's the way it's presented in Germany, even. This article comes from Deutsche Welle, which is the German information office, so to speak. So this is what they say. And the title of the permanent exhibition, which will be there, is called Munich and National Socialism. Munich, of course, being the home of National Socialism, where Hitler and his party and his whole concept began, and then spread throughout the rest of Germany. The exhibition will cover approximately 1,000 square meters and will be constructed in the coming weeks. The exhibition covers the dramatic period from World War I through to the origins, rise, and then crimes of the Nazi Party, through to Germany's new beginnings in 1945. Well, that's how they describe it. So you can see from this that Germany today is a country that celebrates its own defeat in two world wars and accepts the conqueror's victory as a liberation. But did the Germans back at that time want to be liberated from their National Socialist government headed by Adolf Hitler? No, they fought with all they had, including women, boys, and old men, to defend their nation and homeland from the invaders. And what happened then to Germans that they can go along with this today, that they're not rising up and saying, no, this isn't our story, the story you're telling? Well, it's a story that can be called the conquest of Germany as a Reich, as a united force, and as a noble race. Why have the Germans been singled out for refusal to allow them to have their nation? Really, among so many, one of the few people in the world that is not allowed to have their nation under their own direction? And why have they been singled out for punishment, such extreme punishment, when they refuse to acquiesce to that? Especially if they don't acquiesce to this, to what has been done to their nation, then they get even more extreme punishment. I mean, not even more than they ever got, but very extreme punishment today in the form of being taken to court, being fined, heavy fines, being put in prison, and being, you might say, desocialized, being out of work, and so on. The answer to this, ladies and gentlemen, and this is not the first time it's been said, but in the simplest terms, it's because of the powerful rise of the Jews. Well, where did these Jews rise up so powerfully? I'm going to go do a little brief history, or stroll back through history here for a moment, and cover this ground once more. That William the Conqueror was the first Norman king of England. He reigned from 1066 until his death in 1087. I said here that he was a Norman. He came from Normandy and successfully defeated the current king in England and became the first Norman king of England. Eight successions later, in 1272, Edward the First became the king, and 18 years later, in 1290, he had to have become aware that the Jews had become a major problem in England, probably wielding too much influence in his realm, and no doubt with many particulars spelled out, because in that year he had them expelled and not allowed to enter again. There had to be have been a reason why he did that. Certainly was not anti-Semitism. It was because he had determined that they were bad for his kingdom. This lasted until Protestant Oliver Cromwell and Charles II allowed some Jews back in 1649, some 300 years later. Then more and more came. Why did Cromwell do that? Well, was it only for Jewish gold? That would be one reason. But in 1740, about 100 years, less than 100 years later, that they had been allowed back in, the Jews were very surprisingly granted citizenship of that country, mainly favored, this move was mainly favored by the upper classes and the leaders, and leaders in the Protestant church. Britain had gone Protestant. But the common people were so outraged at this that in 1740, that the 1740 law was abrogated 13 years later, so that would have been in 1753. Now, when they say common people, I don't think it means poor people. It means the commoners, which were those who weren't the aristocrats. So it would include a lot of business people, professional people, shopkeepers, and so on, you know, who found that this gift to the Jews was totally out of place, and they made such a fuss at that time that they had to change the law. Well, what happened then? The Jews were still allowed to be in the country, but they weren't citizens, so they converted to Christianity. And with their gold, mixed themselves in with the aristocracy and married into it and so on. If they hadn't already started, but they were continuing to do that, they became Christians and changed their names. And then once they married into other families, they would have become citizens. Their children certainly would have been. That is then that these Jews became regular British folk in time, and very wealthy ones too, who hold titles and have huge amounts of land and so on. And this is how, in a very simplified form, Britain became a Jewish nation, which it is today, I would say, I think it is, and I think we need to recognize that. And what was Germany doing all this time? Well, a very different story we see for Germany. Basically, it was playing out its role as the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation under the Catholic Church, which was very anti-Jewish at that time, and for a long time it remained very anti-Jewish. So there you have the British becoming Protestant and friendly with Jews, and you have Germany in a more spiritual role under the Catholic Church and the Pope, where Jews were considered to be unwanted. You know, Jews were not a part of who they were. Briefly then, in the year 800, Pope Leo III crowned the Frankish. This is how the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation took form. In the year 800, Pope Leo III crowned the Frankish king Charlemagne as emperor. So the Frankish king was basically German, even though it's Frankreich is the word for France, but there's a overlap there. The title continued in the Carolingian family, and Charlemagne was a Carolingian that Charles and Carol are basically the same name. And in this Carolingian family, they continue to rule as emperors, and their rule was contested by Italian rulers. And you can understand that because it was all under Rome, the Holy Roman Empire, you know, until 924, when finally the last of the Italian rulers who sought to challenge the Germans lost or died or whatever, and there weren't any more that tried to do that. So, and at that time, 924, Otto the First was crowned emperor. And some people say that the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation began with Otto the First, and others, historians say, no, it began with Charlemagne, but in any case, these were two very important men, both Germans. This empire lasted until 1806. From 800 or 924 till 1806. And it was considered by itself as the continuation of the original Roman Empire. That is, the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation considered itself to be the continuation of the original Roman Empire and got its legitimacy from that. So in essence, the Germans beat out the Italians for this title, and they held it for a long time. So they were caught up with that, and this empire was a loosely arranged group of all kinds of different units and duchies and so on, not particularly tightly organized. The way it ended in 1806 was that Emperor Francis II dissolved the empire on 6th August 1806 because they were defeated by Napoleon at the Battle of Austerlitz. So upon that defeat by Napoleon, the empire dissolved, and I guess you could say maybe everybody was on their own then. But that wasn't very much longer that many things took place, because in 1871 is the date of the unification of Germany under Bismarck. So, and Frederick the Great had been playing a big role in there, so that we're really up into modern times here already. And so now, I'm saying, that around 1800, we have Jewish Britain and Christian Central Europe. So with this, you've got a large part of the answer as to why Germany has been treated the way it has. Now, just continuing on here, Adolf Hitler was born in 1889, 75 years after the end of the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation ended. And he grew up there in Austria. He moved to Germany and fought bravely in World War I during 1914 to 18. And during his youth, anti-Semitic thought and politics was a part of the German national character, in large part. Not everyone, and they, you know, Jews had made a lot of inroads in Germany, but generally there was not a lot of acceptance across the board of Jews. And in 1919, Hitler decided to join, after he got out of the, after the end of World War I, he decided to join and take over a very small anti-Semitic, anti-communist workers' party in Munich. In 1920, he gave a public speech in the Great Hall of the Hofbrauhaus, titled, Why We Are Anti-Semites. And he began this speech in his usual straightforward way. He said, My dear countrymen and women, we are quite used to being generally referred to as monsters. He meant his party, the NSDAP. And we are considered particularly monstrous because in a question that certain gentlemen in Germany are nervous about, we are marching at the head, namely in the question of the opposition to the Jews. So we can well understand that Jewish Britain and Jewish America, along with being against Germany for economic reasons, and the Jews were part of that economics also, and why they would be against Germany for economic reasons, but now they had reason for their Jewish element to be against her, to be against Germany, for that reason, for the agitation of anti-Semitism and the rise of Adolf Hitler. So the Jews in the U.S. and the Jews in Britain, along with the Jew communists of the Soviet Union, set about to defeat Hitler and keep his ideas down forever. In other words, to stamp them out. They succeeded in that, taking over Germany after the Second World War to such an extent that they replaced everything that had been with their own Allied and German version of it, using guilt for the war, for the concentration camps, for the deportation of Jews, etc., etc., with lies about gypsies and homosexuals too, and all foreigners, etc., etc. In other words, by giving Germans a totally substitute historical narrative, media, publishing, educational system, political parties, movies, and then television, etc., and making it illegal to speak positively about National Socialism, Adolf Hitler, the Third Reich, etc. So that is what they did, and thus it is that up to today, the German state is the worst critic of all against its own past, everyone and everything connected to the Third Reich. You don't find any other nation being more anti-Nazi and and clinging to the authorized version of World War II, etc., than the German government of today. And without your own state supporting you, you can get nowhere. Germans could get very far. There's a lot that could be done if their nation supported their efforts, but it does not. It's with totally with the enemy. So this takeover was totalitarian and deadly serious in its scope. Germany's new leaders had to accept all Allied demands in order to have a semblance of independence again. A new constitution, in quotes, was prepared that based the Federal Republic of Germany's legal existence on the findings of the Nuremberg military tribunals. Thus, the new Federal Republic of Germany, FGR, has never been a sovereign nation that can decide against what it has been decided for it by its multiple conquerors. The only clout Germany as a nation has gained for itself over the years is its economic success due to the racial qualities of its people, which is why it was targeted for destruction to begin with. So the strength of Germany are also what the Jews in the countries that they control fear and want to hold down. So it's kind of a conundrum here where they want the strength, Europe wants the strength of the German people and its economy, but at the same time it can't allow Germany to get to go beyond the bounds or to get out of the ring that is put it that it has been put in. And do anything on its own. So Germany's economic strength, and I've said this many times before, is appreciated as long as it's in the service of the Anglo-American global order. And the same with its leadership. Its leadership has to be in the service of this order also. So the biggest problem is, then, that the German government is not on the side of the Germans. It's on the side of the Allies. Just imagine having a government that's on the side of those who defeated you. But they get around that by saying that Adolf Hitler's government was a criminal government and it was a despotic rule forced on the German people because there were a few that didn't like it, but most were happy with it. But they say that, you know, therefore they had to free Germany from that. So Germany is now should be grateful for being freed by the Allies and being able to be a part of the world democracies and so on, and has to do it. But it's stuck with this guilt and shame that it is supposed to carry around and feel, so that it will continue to do what these others want them to do. So this leads me to the two subjects for tonight's show. The first one is the repression of the criminal treatment of German women and children by American, British, and French troops from 1944 to 1947, mainly during that time. The second will be the current status of the organization representing the 15 million ethnic Germans who were forced out of their homes in Eastern Europe in a death march to a much reduced German territory as refugees. So on to the first subject, it's 8:23 already. How could that be happening? The latest example of this is the appearance of a new book by a German historian named Miriam Gebhardt, who hails from very close to where my ancestors came from in Baden. She's from Freiburg, which is south of the Black Forest, but my ancestors are from north of the Black Forest in the Kraichgau. But she is described as a highly regarded historian with several books to her credit before this one. She fits into the mainstream. She's not going out on the limb, but she seems to be going out on the limb a few times as far as being a woman. She has written a well-received, I guess, biography of this woman whose last name is Schwarzer, who is a German feminist. She wrote about her. She's not a bad feminist, because I read about her, and she's mostly the ideas she has, I think, are good, helpful for women. Some in a couple areas she goes further than I would approve of. But this Miriam Gebhardt, who wrote this new book, has come out now with another one that circles around women, and that is When the Soldiers Came, the Rape of German Women at the End of the Second World War. She calls that the repressed crime. She mostly wants to bring out the rapes by Americans, because that is what has not been talked about up till now. And some in a newspaper interview, she said some things such as, the false impression grew up after the war that German women gave themselves to Western soldiers because they brought with them things they desperately needed, nylons, food, cigarettes, coffee. That's very true. The stories are, and always have been, that these women were quite willing to give sex to these American soldiers who were so nice, you know, so attractive and nice to be with. And because they had need of, they wanted special things like nylon stockings. You know, nobody needs nylons, but they might keep your legs warmer if you don't have anything on your legs. That's true. Nobody needs cigarettes, but if you're a smoker, you do. And food and coffee, so mostly it was like special things that they wanted to get. And gave out that therefore these German women, because they lived in, their times were so hard, to say the least, they were willing to prostitute themselves. And Miriam Gebhardt also says the impression grew that there was no rape in the West, but rather a kind of prostitution grew up. Well, that's what I said. But in fact, she says countless women were raped, with soldiers believing they could treat them as they wanted after bearing coveted gifts. Post-war society was hardly ready to differentiate between voluntary and forced sexual contact. She then added to the trauma of the Western victims was the shame suffered by the children they bore from their attackers. Their fathers were mostly unknown, and the women received no financial help at all. She said in parts of southern Germany, occupied by American troops, there were often what were called free nights, where soldiers were encouraged to abuse women at will for up to 48 hours at a time. This is from the journalist who wrote this, and I don't know if she actually says that there were these happened often. There was one place where it was happening, but that might be a little incorrect there. And she says that the victims are relieved that their hardship is now coming to light. So this was all from the person who wrote the Daily Mail article, which happens to be that horrible Alan Hall. However, there was also something in Der Spiegel by Klaus V. Greffe titled Post-War Rapes Were Americans as Bad as the Soviets. And I'm going to read this. Probably easier just to read it. He writes, in the popular imagination, American GIs in post-war Germany were well-liked and well-behaved in the popular imagination, remember. But a new book claims that U.S. soldiers raped up to 190,000 women, U.S. soldiers, at the end of World War II. Is there any truth to the controversial claim? Says the soldiers arrived at dusk. They forced their way into the house and tried to drag the two women upstairs. But Catherine W. and her 18-year-old daughter, Charlotte, were able to escape. The soldiers didn't give up easily, though. They began searching all the houses in the area and ultimately found the two women in a neighbor's closet shortly before midnight. The men pulled them out and threw them onto two beds. The crime of the six soldiers, six of them, ultimately committed took place in March 1945, shortly before the end of World War II. The girl cried for help, "Mama, Mama," but none arrived. Hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of German women experienced a similar fate, but that's all across, that's including from the Russians. But she says this case was different. This was not in the carried out by Soviet troops. These rapists were soldiers from the United States of America, and the crime took place in Sprendlingen, a village near the Rhine River in the West. Okay, by the end of the war, some 1.6 million American troops had advanced deep into Germany, ultimately meeting the advancing Soviets at the Elbe River. In the U.S., those who freed Europe from what they called the plague of the Nazis came to be known as the Greatest Generation. In the U.S., that is. And Germans, too, developed a positive image of their occupiers. So it said, cool soldiers who handed out chewing gum to the children and wowed the German fraulines with jazz and nylons. But is that image consistent with reality? German historian Miriam Gebhardt, well known in Germany for her book about Alice Schwarzer, that's the leading feminist in Germany, Alice Schwarzer, and the so-called feminist movement, has now published a new volume casting doubt on the accepted version of America's role in German post-war history. The work, which came out on Monday, takes a closer look at the rape of German women by all four victorious powers at the end of World War II. In particular, though, her views on the behavior of American GIs are likely to raise eyebrows. Gebhardt believes that members of the U.S. military raped as many as 190,000 German women by the time West Germany regained sovereignty in 1955, so-called sovereignty. So that's from 45 to 55, over 10 years, 190,000 rapes. With most of the assaults taking place in the months immediately following the U.S. invasion of Nazi Germany, the author bases her claims in large part on reports kept by Bavarian priests in the summer of 1945. The Archbishop of Munich and Freising had asked Catholic clergy to keep records on the Allied advance, and the Archdiocese published excerpts from its archive a few years ago. Only a few years ago, they published this. Michael Merksmüller, a priest in the village of Ramsau, near Berchtesgaden, wrote on July 20th, 1945, for example, 8 girls and women raped, some of them in front of their parents. Father Andreas Weingand from Hague under Amper, a tiny village located just north of where the Munich airport is today, wrote on July 25th, 1945, the saddest event during the advance were 3 rapes, one on a married woman, one on a single woman, and one on a spotless girl of 16 and a half. They were committed by heavily drunken Americans. And a lot of these rapes were after these soldiers had been drinking. And then they had no reserve about them. They just went after it. You know, they became brutes. And the same was true with the Russians and the Mongols coming in from the east, but also in the west. And they didn't stop them from drinking. So what their behavior then was kind of predictable, maybe, for some of them. Father Alois Schimmel from Moosburg wrote on August 1, 1945, by order of the military government, a list of all residents and their ages must be nailed to the door of each house. The results of this decree are not difficult to imagine. 17 girls or women were brought to the hospital, having been sexually abused once or several times. So the military government ordered that they needed to post a list of who lived in each house and their ages. So then, you know, they went look for the young women. their soldiers did. Now, in this report, of these 17, the youngest was 7 years old, and the oldest was a woman of 69. The reports led book author Gebhardt to compare the behavior of the U.S. Army with the violent excesses perpetrated by the Red Army in the eastern half of the country, where brutality, gang rapes, and incidents of looting have dominated the public perception of the Soviet occupation. Gebhardt, however, says that the rapes committed in Upper Bavaria show that things weren't much different in post-war Germany, south and west. That's, again, you know, I'll say again, that's where my family's from, and the southwestern part is where they, I guess they crossed. A lot of them were there, and so these German women there got the worst of it. And I was thinking, you know, I've thought before about having, distant cousins still living there. Thinking, I wonder if some of them, because there was a lot, that's where the Negro soldiers were too, doing all that raping. I wonder if some of my distant cousins might be part African for that reason. Anyway, says the historian, also believes that the U.S. soldiers were horrified by the crimes committed by the Germans. Now, this is the reasoning that's given, that they were told and shown pictures and sometimes shown places that about the crimes committed by the German soldiers and the Wehrmacht and the SS. And this made them, why they should be embittered, I don't know, but this made them embittered and wanting to strike out at these Germans. And so they struck out at the women as though they had some sort of justification for it. This is a justification that's given. However, we know that Eisenhower and the Allied Control Commission and so on played this stuff up and invented a lot of it so that the German people could be harshly punished. And so these so-called crimes by the Germans were never committed. They weren't guilty of these crimes that they are being punished for. Furthermore, along with what they thought the Germans had done to these other people and all the death and destruction that they had caused, that they saw a relatively high degree of prosperity in the country. Well, the greatest prosperity was probably in the West and even in the Southwest, because there's a lot of agriculture going on there, and there was not as much damage there. So, you know, they got a wrong impression at that too, but of course their own military was trying to give them very wrong impressions. And then the propaganda at the time conveyed the idea to them that German women were attracted to them and really wanted, you know, really were waiting for them, further fueling their macho fantasies. So let's see here. Now, I think what's really interesting I want to bring out is that the thinking about this all along, and certainly today, is this idea of is this debate between what kind of relationship existed between the soldiers and these German women. And many historians are taking a more critical look at the behavior of the American military during the days immediately preceding and following the end of World War II in Germany. They have found incidents involving, or maybe just coming out with them, involving GIs plundering churches, murdering Italian civilians, killing German prisoners of war, and raping women, as we're talking about. As they advanced, even across France, they were doing that. Despite such findings, the Americans are still considered to have been relatively disciplined compared to the Soviets and the French. But Gebhardt, he says, this writer says, is hoping to challenge that. Still, you know, how much the reports compiled by the Catholic Church in Bavaria only add up, he says, to a few hundred cases. So how did she arrive at the shocking figure of 190,000 rapes? And this is what she's being criticized for. But what she did was to extrapolate. She made the assumption that 5% of the war children, that is the illegitimate children born to unmarried women in West Germany and West Berlin, by the mid-1950s were the product of rape. 5% of them, she figured, must have been the product of rape. So that makes for a total of 1,900 children of American fathers. So that's the number. But then she further assumes that on average there are 100 incidents of rape for each birth. And that leads her to the figure of 190,000 rape victims. Well, is it unreasonable to assume that if you have there would be 100 incidents of rape for each birth? That seems a little high to me. I wouldn't go that high if I just off the top of my head. I would understand that criticism. Now, people are saying that that doesn't seem hardly plausible. And she doesn't have enough other evidence. But she does have there is a lot of evidence of very bad behavior by Americans. And another previous to her, going back a little ways, there's a U.S. criminologist and professor, Robert Lilly, or Lily, L-I-L-L-Y, who wrote a book, I can't think of the name of it right now, who examined rape cases prosecuted by American military courts. So, you know, some of them were prosecuted. And he arrived at this would only be a part of them. He arrived at a number of 11,000 serious sexual assaults committed by November 1945, and then they would have continued on after that. So I think if he was going by what was known and what was recorded there, that he's got to have a very low number. And he had 11,000 by November 45. So I don't think this Ms. Gebhardt can be just dismissed altogether by what she's saying, because there's always a whole lot more unrecorded than there are recorded. Anyway, okay, here's something that's on record. A complaint filed by a hotelier in Munich on May 31st, 1945, reported that U.S. soldiers had commandeered a few rooms at her hotel, this is in Munich, and that four women were running around completely naked and were exchanged several times. And she questions, was that really voluntary, that these women were up there with these soldiers? Even if it isn't likely that Americans committed 190,000 sexual crimes, this writer says, it remains true that for post-war victims of rape, which was undeniably a mass phenomenon at the end of World War II, there is no culture of memory, no public recognition, much less an apology from the perpetrators. And today, 70 years after the end of the war, unfortunately, it doesn't look as though that situation will soon change. And that's the same for everything about that war. There's no apologies, no recognition, no memory of what actually happened allowed. And this Gebhardt woman was interviewed as many elderly German women as she could who experienced this back then and talked to them and got their stories. But, of course, you're going to have everyone's not wanting to accept it. Now, she is a well-known historian already in Germany. She's middle-aged, and she's got a reputation to uphold. She's a professor in a university. She's not going to just write a bunch of nonsense, but she... because she's a woman, see, she wants to do things like this for women, for the women. And not that she wants to make it up, but I can understand. She's, you know, this gives her more feeling, more sense of that she's accomplishing something that means something to her. And so I don't think that she would just go out and lie about it. And she's very open about how she came to her number of 190,000. So you can say, well, that's not possible. Or it is possible, or anywhere in between. I think she should be listened to. But now we have an article about this in the Telegraph, UK, and it's by Anthony Beevor. Now, Anthony Beevor crops up everywhere about this subject. Wherever I look, they're consulting Anthony Beevor, because he's one of the great, according to the British, one of their great authorities on the Second World War. And he's a historian, of course. And he says, well, he dismisses it. He says it's almost impossible to come up with figures, But I think to say there were hundreds of thousands is a great exaggeration. If she's doing it on the basis of illegitimate children, that's ludicrous. There was a huge amount of voluntary sex. How does he know? Where was he? There were vast numbers of cases of genuine fraternization. Well, the Americans had a law against fraternization, rules against it. Many young women were hanging around outside the gates of American camps, he said. And he says the most notorious instances of rape by Western Allied forces were by French troops during the sack of Stuttgart. Well, that's when the African troops were allowed to go into Stuttgart and rape everybody, every woman that they could get their hands on. That's another horrible story, which does, you know, is a part of this whole thing, but the worst part. Now, he just doesn't want to go along with it. And, you know, I also had a question. If one woman or girl was raped multiple times, which certainly was the case with the Russians and would have been the case elsewhere too, then how do you count that? How many rapes is that? Well, you're just going to count one woman raped, no matter how many times she was raped. I found a site called pictureshistory.blogspot.com, and it had a page on rape during World War II, and there's some very good, all documented here, I mean all sourced, very well sourced, about the rapes and about Americans and British and French. And it's John Dos Passos, a famous American fiction writer, or I don't know if it's all fiction actually, but a writer, said in Life magazine on June 7th, 1946, that lust, whiskey, and plunder was the reward for the soldier, or a reward. And a soldier wrote in Time magazine on November 12th, 1945, it showed up. The quote is, "A lot of normal American families would be horrified if they knew how utterly insensitively our boys behaved here." And, you know, it's not just with rapes. It's with the whole way that they behaved in Germany, coming in as though they were some great warrior conquerors, which, of course, most of them weren't at all, and just taking everything. The Americans were famous for grabbing souvenirs, the American soldiers. They just took everything, anything they could, they thought that would make a good souvenir for them. A lot of them who had access to Hitler's places where he had lived, really went crazy taking things. And they were allowed to do that because Americans were not strict disciplinarians with their troops, as much as they want to say that they were. They were not. They encouraged them to have a good time. An army sergeant wrote, quote, "And our army and British army had their share of looting and rape. Although these crimes are not typical for our troops, but their percentage is high enough to give our army a sinister reputation so that we too can be called an army of tyrants." An Italian survivor of American bombing notes that black U.S. troops stationed in Naples, with the permission of his superiors, had free access to the poor, hungry, and humiliated Italian women. The result of these interracial rape and sexual slavery was the production of generations of pathetic children. And according to an Associated Press report on September 12, 1945, entitled "German-American Marriages Were Prohibited," here's what the American military comes out with. On September 12, 1945, they put out a report. Well, they put out a report, and the Associated Press picked it up and published it, said that German-American marriages were prohibited, that the government of Franklin Roosevelt has advised its soldiers that marriage with the inferior German girls were absolutely forbidden, but those who had children out of wedlock from German women, whose husbands or suitors were dead, captured, or imprisoned in concentration camps, that is, if they didn't have any German man around, could count on allowance. According to Time magazine, dated 17 September 1945, the government supplied the soldiers some 50 million condoms a month with picturesque illustrations of their use. Well, who are they going to use these condoms with? Of course, they're telling themselves, they're fantasizing, the whole military government is fantasizing that these German women want to have sex, so our soldiers might as well have a good time. that's what they told themselves, is they're handing out 50 million condoms a month to their soldiers. And the soldiers were told, it is said, quote, teach these Germans a lesson and spend a nice time. There you go. Again, just like with Ilya Ehrenberg, teach these Germans a lesson. And they certainly wanted to do that. They wanted to subjugate the Germans totally, completely, and including the women. To go on, black rapes. Okay. According to testimony given in the U.S. Senate, July 17, 1945, when the colonial Free French troops under the command of Eisenhower, most of them Africans, were stationed in the German city of Stuttgart, they herded German women into the subway and raped about 2,000 of them. This is testimony given in the U.S. Senate in July 1945. And this was under the command of Eisenhower. And they know all this, but what's done? Nothing is done. In Stuttgart alone, troops under Eisenhower's command raped more women in 1 week than the German troops raped in France for the entire 4 years. Well, they keep saying that German troops were raping. I imagine a few did so, but I don't know if this person has any exact facts. I'm not going to say that no Germans ever raped a woman, but it is a fact that it goes on to say it is a fact of all the major belligerents in World War II, rape and looting by German troops was the lowest. And it was so low, it's practically non-existent. If you ask me, the fact is that the level of rape by the German army in the occupied territories was even lower than the level of rape by the American troops stationed on home soil. So once Americans got inducted into the army and or the navy or something and put on the uniform, even when they were still on home soil, they started raping. So rape is something of an American thing, much more than it is certainly of a German thing. It never was a German thing, ever. Oh, and this is well known, that this is a London International News story dated 31st January 1946. But as we've known for a long time, or I read about it a long time ago, when the wives of American soldiers arrived in Germany, and they let a lot of these soldiers' wives come, I don't think privates, but maybe officers' wives. When they arrived in Germany, they gave them special military uniforms to wear. And the reason is because they didn't want the U.S. soldiers, the lower class soldiers, to mistake these officers' wives for the German Fräulein. That's how they spell it here, Fräulein, for the German girls. And that was known that's why they had these wives wearing military uniforms of some sort. Now, I have to pick and choose here. Some of this might be kind of repetitive, so I can... This thing about the blacks. Here, I'll read this quote here from... No, this is in Wikipedia. After the fighting moved on to German soil for the Americans, this is about the U.S. military, there was a good deal of rape by combat troops and those immediately following them. The incidents varied between unit and unit according to the attitude of the commanding officer. In some cases, offenders were identified, tried by court-martial, and punished. The Army legal branch was reticent, but admitted that for brutal or perverted sexual offenses against German women, some soldiers had to be shot, particularly if they happened to be Negroes. So at that time, they were willing to shoot a few Negroes because what they did was so terrible, but they didn't really want to punish the white soldier. Yet I know for a fact, this goes on to say, that many women were raped by white Americans. No action was taken against the culprits. In one sector, a report went round that a certain very distinguished army commander made the wisecrack, quote, copulation without conversation does not constitute fraternization. Well, that actually was a common sort of a saying among the soldiers because they had a non-fraternization policy that the American under Eisenhower instituted immediately. No fraternization with people here, with the natives, according to the for the soldiers. But they said, they decided that if they copulated with a woman without any conversation, that's not fraternization. And they actually tried to do that then, so that they were thought they were keeping within the law. This is from a book by Osmar White, published by Cambridge and New York, Cambridge University Press, called An Eyewitness Report of Germany, 1945. And typical victimization was sexual assault by drunken American personnel marching through occupied territory involved threatening a German family with weapons, forcing one or more women to engage in sex, and putting the entire family out on the street afterward. This is from Peter Schrivers in a book published by New York University. As in the eastern sector of the occupation, the number of rapes peaked in 1945, but a high rate of violence against the German and Austrian populations by the Americans lasted at least into the first half of 1946, with 5 cases of dead German women found in American barracks in May and June of 1946 alone. Now, there's an interesting debate here that I want to get to, but I want to say that there's some stuff about the British, too, and, of course, the French were terrible. The French were the worst. They had so much hatred for the and competitiveness and so on with the Germans that they got carried away. And according to Norman Neimark, French Moroccan troops matched the behavior of Soviet troops when it came to rape, in particular in the early occupation of Baden and Württemberg. See, I take that personally. That's where my family came from. So they got it the worst, except for the Berlin and those in the east. There's a woman called Elizabeth Heinemann at the University of Iowa, and she has written some things. And she has argued that in post-war Germany, especially in West Germany, the wartime rape stories became an essential part of political discourse, and that the rape of German women, along with the expulsion of Germans from the East and Allied occupation, had been universalized in an attempt to situate the German population on the whole as victims. She's saying that some people were arguing in the political discourse that Germans were trying to universalize what took place in an attempt to make themselves on the whole as victims, not just some people victims, not just say these women who were raped as victims, but all Germans as victims. And this became a debate between the left and others who are not on the left. And this discourse was wholly discredited by the late 1960s. Since the 1970s, from the 1970s on, the German leftists conducted politics focused on critical investigation of the Nazi past, the older generation's unwillingness to face that past, and their tendency to portray themselves as victims rather than as perpetrators, particularly of the Holocaust. Therefore, it is argued the frequently iterated claim that the wartime rapes had been surrounded by decades of silence is perhaps not correct. This is written very badly. I don't know why. I may have had to use a Google Translate. But what I find very interesting in this is that the idea that they're not going to allow Germans to be victims. The left is not going to allow it. And the Jews either, of course. They never mention the Jews, of course. Let's call it left, they're actually communists after the war. And particularly after some time went by, once you got into the 70s, started in the 60s. But there was the Germans were talking about it. German women were talking about it. They weren't trying to do anything about it. Everybody knew that it had taken place, what had taken place. And they knew what they had experienced and suffered, but they also knew that there was no sympathy for them. But then the leftists tried to rid of any sympathy whatsoever for Germans by pointing to their Nazi past and saying all how what they deserved, everything they got, you know, the whole thing we hear all the time. They deserve it. You know, they're the perpetrators. And if they're the perpetrators, as is said by the Nuremberg Tribunal, which is the law of the land and accepted by everyone, so they're the perpetrators, they can't be the victims too. So they just would always stop any kind of sympathy for Germans for what had happened and shut it up and so on. That's how I see it. And this Heinemann writes that a woman who lived through that time, attended a lecture, and confronted the accuser speaker who was accusing the Germans of, you know, being perpetrators and so on. And he was a German. And she asked him the question, when were you born? And he answered 1946, which was, of course, after the war. And she said, it's always you who did not live through this time who accuse us of not confronting our past. That was the thing that was going on then. I'm sorry this is a little jumbled here, but the thing that was going on was that, oh, you Germans, you're refusing to confront your past. You still haven't confronted all the bad things you did. You are the perpetrators. You want to present yourself as victims. You're failing to confront the past. And this was what pushed the German government into overdoing the confrontation of their past and being willing to pay out all this money and admit all these crimes and do all this stuff. Whereas in the beginning, they were not ready to do that, and they weren't really doing it. They were just trying to live and get their country back together to some degree as best they could, and they didn't have time for all this other stuff, you know, all this political debate. So this is what this man was doing. You know, you haven't confronted your past. And this woman said, those people who didn't live then don't understand that we were too busy staying alive, finding shelter and food to have time for that, and so on and so on. She said it better than that. But in any case, this is one of the tricks and the worst things that have been done to the Germans, is to not allow them to have their memories and to have at least consideration for their suffering and what was done to them, and only that anything bad that was done to them, whether it be the rapes, whether it be the expulsions, well, what do you expect? Whoa, how should they be treated? They deserved it. You know, they were all part of this evil thing that happened. And of course, as we know, the most evil of all, the Holocaust, is a big lie. So all of this has been done to prevent the Germans ever from rising and becoming the threat again that they were back then to the British and Americans and so on, becoming the people that they are. They've had to be held down, but not so much that they can't be used as sort of like animals, livestock are used for the farmer to help him enrich himself. But they themselves are not allowed to decide what it is that they will do and will not do. Then I went on this forum where they were talking about this book by Gebhardt, and it's a World War II forum called the URL www2f.com, worldwar2forum.com is what it stands for, and they had the same kind of big resistance going on. They hadn't read the book, but they were just told about it, and so then they all had their opinions, and they just don't want to believe it. They don't believe it. They think she's wrong, and that's a woman for you, and so on. And this one says, I'm sure there were some rapes, but the sort of mass thing being described is probably due to not wanting to admit, even to themselves, that they traded sex for food, for survival in a hungry time. Certainly, some of them were reduced to that. But is that right? In 45... and even into 46, the Germans were being starved. They were being given nothing, and there's plenty they could have been given. And then when the aid came through more big time, the Marshall Plan, and before that, what's that president? Can't think of his name. He brought a bunch of aid to Europe, but most of it went to France, Belgium, even Britain, and very little got to Germany. And that was not known, because in the United States they were told that, oh, we're helping these Germans, we're such great people in spite of what they did, you know, we're humanitarians and we're helping them. But very little got to Germany, and they were starving. They were really they really were starving, and they were hanging around in the dumps, searching around for junk, for crap to eat, you know, and children were starving. Anyway, this other guy says, I'm putting it down as revisionist. There's no real evidence beyond hearsay, and most of the alleged perpetrators are dead and can't reply. You know, and this person, I thought, he's putting it down as revisionist. There's no real evidence beyond hearsay. And yet I'll bet he believes in the Holocaust. And I bet he believes everything that all those, because all those people said so. And that's all hearsay, but he doesn't think about it that way. I'll bet you anything. Or he wouldn't be talking like this if he didn't. They all say, well, you know, these people were defeated, and they had to do these things to get enough to eat and so on. And so, well, it's all understandable. They're never going to blame, not a single one of them, blames the soldiers for what they did or the military government. If I had plenty of time, I'd just read them all, but I don't think I'm going to. Just the usual kind of denial. All right, I'm going to put on a very short piece of music for a break, and then I will come back and talk about the expellee story. And I'm going to play SS song, Wenn alle an Troy wäre. It's only a little over 2 minutes, ladies and gentlemen, so we'll be back very shortly.
Wenn alle untreu werden und bleiben wir noch treu, dass immer noch auf Erden für euch ein Weltlein sei. Der Welt wird untergehen, ihr seht der Welt verteilt, die Kunst und Länder tun und Liebe so gemein. Wollt immer von uns scheinen und immer nahe sein, soll in die deutschen Eisen im Mond und Sonne schein. Ein Schild des Wiederhändes in aller Brüder Seen, die kämen zu der Quelle in Lieb und Freude hin. Ein Schild des Wiederhändes in aller Brüder Seen, Sterne, seid uns Zeugen, die Ruhe wieder schon. Denn alle Brüder schweigen und falschen Wörtern fahren. Wir wollen das Gott entdecken, die Proben werden sein. Und sehen die Geld und Stecken von alten Deutschen ein.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. And this is Carolyn Yeager on the Heretics Hour on Monday, March 9th. I'm sucking on a piece of dark chocolate. I'm going to switch over to other topic for tonight's show. And that is the Federation of Expellees has just, it was actually last year in November, but they voted in a new president. And Erika Steinbach, who many of you may be familiar with her or her name, heard her name, Erika Steinbach was the head of this federation for quite a number of years and was controversial because she aggressively pushed for a recognition of their plight and also of their continuing plight and wanting to keep that alive. She had the friendship of Angela Merkel, the chancellor. She's in that party, the Christian Social Union, which is currently in power, and she earned the hatred of the Polish people, of the Poles and the Polish government, because they were trying to say what could be and what could not be done, particularly with this museum kind of a museum memorial. In honor of the 15 million ethnic Germans who fled or were expelled from parts of Central and Eastern Europe after the war, and up until the 1980s. But they had it differently than the ones who were kicked out right at that time, and even before the war ended. They were truly terrorized. These people were truly being terrorized in a way that the Jews were never terrorized in Germany. They were never treated in the way that these ethnic Germans in Czechoslovakia and in Poland and in other places in the Balkans and so on were absolutely terrorized. And a lot of them were sent to Siberia, to the gulags in northern Russia, and died there. Some of them were released after quite a number of years of hard labor. And a lot of them died. A lot of them were murdered. A lot of them died along the way. So it's given as an official total that there were from 13 to 16 million. And yet in some of these things I've read, they go to the lowest number of all, and they say it was 13 million, when most of the time people average it out and call it 15 million. So an honest number to give for these ethnic Germans that were treated this way was 15 million, and definitely 2 million died from it. So that's pretty big trauma, a pretty big Shoah, pretty big disaster befalling these people. But once again, the idea is, well, what do you expect? It's their own fault. They deserved it. They shouldn't have gone out there. Well, the fact is, of course, they like to say that, oh, a lot of these Germans came there after 1939 and moved into these eastern territories and pushed the inhabitants out. They were pushed further east or arrested or something. Well, very small proportion of Germans from other places moved into Poland and the cities of what you'd call Western Poland and into Czechoslovakia and so on. Most of them, by far the vast majority, had been living there for generations and were very valuable citizens in those areas. And productive and contributed greatly, and they were wanted. They were wanted there, except for the people who like the leftists, the communists. Well, to get started here, what has happened is I started to say that. Okay, I'll say this: when these expellees, as they're called, and the word is kind of long and sort of hard for me to pronounce, but not, I can pronounce it now, but I can't just roll it off my tongue over and over again. But they're the Vertrebienen, Vertrebienen. Anyway, the Bund der Heimat Vertrebienen was the first organization that was formed in Germany in 1950 after they had all gotten there and they realized there were so many of them from all over, and they were in the southern part at that time, southern Germany, and they created this what in English is League of Expellees and Deprived of Rights, because they were very, very conscious at that time and very unhappy that they were kicked out of their homes and their property, and they owned farms and land and businesses and factories and so on, and they were terrorized by these communist partisans. There was mostly the partisans that were allowed to run loose there, and they would strike fear in them and come in their homes and tear everything up and threaten them and kill if anybody said anything. If they wanted to rape a woman and the husband tried to intervene or a son or something, they'd kill him. So it was all very terrible. And then they were told, once they had, there was no German Wehrmacht support for them anymore, they were told that they had to leave. And they had to leave suddenly, very quickly. And they could only take such and such amount that weighed so much. So that's why so many of them look, when you see pictures of them, on the roads and so on, they look like they're very well dressed, like, boy, these must have been wealthy people. Well, they put on their best clothes because they couldn't take very much. They had a little bag or a bundle, and they would have to think about what was most important, and they put on their very best clothes, so they would have those instead of old clothes. And they were thrown out of there, and at the time that they got to Germany, those who managed to get there in one piece very much had in their mind that they wanted to go return. You know, they thought they would be able to return later. They hoped they could. They wanted to go back to their homes and to that land that they had always lived in and they loved. But they never were allowed to return. But that was their whole thing, was, you know, so that's why they call themselves deprived of rights. They were deprived of their rights, and they wanted laws passed to help them out. They wanted Germany to help them out to get, you know, see that they could eventually get back there. Well, of course, as we know, Germany was not ever in a position to help any of its people, really, and wasn't going to. So in 1957, that first organization was disbanded for whatever reason, and they formed a new one called just the Federation of Expellees. And the first president was Hans Krüger, who happened to live in that part of the world, and he was a former National Socialist judge and activist. And after the war, he was a West German politician for the Christian Democratic Union and a member of parliament from 1957 to 1965, because he had been a very important man and a very good judge and a fair-minded man, but he was involved in the government of his own country. You know, here's the thing that I might as well say right now, that they want all Germans to believe and accept that any German who was a National Socialist at the time or continued with any sympathy for National Socialism after 45, mid-45, is somebody totally unqualified to do anything and must be treated the way that all Nazis are treated today, you know, or all neo-Nazis, whatever, as completely, you must shun these people and don't allow them in, don't allow them to do anything. But a lot of them were at that time, early on, because they were the capable and competent people, and they were good people, like this Krüger was. So he, even in the new government of Ludwig Erhard, he served as federal minister for displaced persons, refugees, and war victims for 4 months, and that was from in 1963 and 1964. And then he was denounced as being a former National Socialist judge and a member of the National Socialist Party. And a big furor was done up in order to get rid of him. And he stepped down from the Chancellor's cabinet and every other position that he had, including he was no longer the head of this Federation of Expellees. And he was in the Federation of Expellees. He was succeeded by Wenzel Jaksch in 1964. That was the end of the line for Hans Krüger. Now, Wenzel Jaksch, turns out I know about him. He was active in Prague in Czechoslovakia as an ethnic German who was very pro-Czechoslovakia. He was very loyal. That was his country, you know, and that was all right, but he was known to be not violently anti-Nazi, but not friendly at all, basically anti-National Socialist rather than pro. And so it was safe to elect him to be the head of this organization. But he died 2 years after that, so he didn't last very long. And then they had to find another one. But this organization went on. And in 1991, the West German government passed several laws dealing with German expellees. The most notable of these is the Law of Return. Well, that was one, though, that granted any ethnic German the right to come back to Germany, to come and live in Germany. So that was a German law for Germans. But whatever that Germany might have laws they might have passed didn't have any power in the new Poland, Republic of Poland, or the Czech Republic. So that didn't do any good, but they wanted the German government to help to stand behind them, to be for them, to help them, you know, try to get the right to get their property back or to move back to their property or to get some compensation for their property. I don't know what all the efforts were that they were doing, but they had not given up on that, even though many other people thought that could never take place, but they hadn't given up on it. Now, in the present day, you know, the CDU and the SPD, the Social Democratic Party, which was always anti-Hitler for the most part, but not, they quieted down and they just stayed quiet when he was in power. And as soon as that war was over, well, then they came out strong, you know, as the ones who should be running the country now, along with the new way of thinking. And they basically did. But they favored improved relations with Central and Eastern Europe, see, and that this is where the whole thing is. As soon as particularly Poland and Czech Republic, but others too, were just completely closed to the Germans ever coming back or getting any part of anything that they had there, and made out like they were there illegally or something, and they didn't owe them anything. And of course, the Benesch decree says that it's a law in the Czech Republic that I forget now how it goes. I should have looked that up before the show, but anyway, they're completely close to that, and they got upset because Erika Steinbach in the 2000s and late 90s and so on, when she became president, her family had been in Silesia, and they had property and so on, and she was more argumentative with the Poles, and the Poles really hated her, and the Germans would not, Germans mainly were more sympathetic and sensitive to the Poles and the Czechs than they were to, particularly the Poles, than they were to their fellow Germans. And so I've got here that how the Poles operate, I say. In February 2009, the Polish newspaper Polska wrote that over one-third of the Federation top officials were former Nazi activists, and based this on an article published by the German magazine Der Spiegel in 2006. So that's what they use all the time. That's how they shut Germans up, by calling them Nazis. If you were formerly a member of the party or had a position in even far out, you know, even not really close in, but with the National Socialist Government, if you did any work for them, you're like a former Nazi, and now you should not be able to do anything at all. And that's how they handle that. So they're always hunting to find out if people had any Nazi connections. And the German paper, the Frankfurter Zeitung, wrote that Der Spiegel said this was not in respect to the Federation of Expellees, but in respect to a predecessor organization that was dissolved in 1957. That was that first one. So the Poles are not honest in the way that they accuse Nazis being involved in these organizations. And the Federation has always been accused of having Nazi roots. And, of course, that first organization, the man who was the head of it, as I already told you about, Hans Kruger, he did, but he wasn't a bad person. Well, I don't think any of them were bad persons, but that's what they keep pointing to. And here's another thing. The large Polish daily newspaper, Rzeczpospolita, reported that during BDV meetings, that's this Federation of Expellees, in 2003, of publications using hate language to describe Poles butchering Germans were available for sale, as were recordings of Waffen SS marches on compact discs, including those marches that were, according to the Poles, glorifying the invasion of Poland. Well, so there you go. You know, you've got Germans at their meetings, and people are trying to sell things to them who are coming to the meetings, and they are. Some of them are about what the Poles did to the Germans who were living there, and these maybe some of these people by 2003 are descendants of the original expellees, and so they might need to be reminded of things like that. But the Poles are called that hate language and lies, you know, which there weren't lies because they were doing that, but they don't want that to be there, and they just like the Jews. Just like the Jews, if you say anything that is reflects badly on Jews, well, that's hate speech. The same difference there. The Federation denied official responsibility for these people who were at these meetings distributing materials. They thought that they should have been more active in that, in keeping them out. And then they talk about how big it is. Well, they claim to have 1.3 million members, which is said to be about half that, actually, that they don't really have that many actual members. But things like that, this goes on. But I want to talk now about the Czechs a minute. Marcus, who writes comment on my site every so often, he wrote on March 1st that the Sudeten-German umbrella group, that's the one we're talking about, gave up their claims to get their property back and their rights to be the rightful owners of that land, and that the Czech president replied that this is necessary for good relations. The Sudetens were in Czechoslovakia, and the Silesians were up in Poland. So they're both here. They're both involved in this. But there's more Sudeten Germans, I think, than Silesian Germans. So, you know, he's complaining about it. But I looked for that, and I think that's just the story that's kind of that goes back a couple of months when this Bernd Fabritius was elected. So I want to go into that a little bit. But first I want to just mention something else that this Czech Republic, current president of the Czech Republic, Miloš Zeman, or if that's how it's pronounced, but it's Zeman, his last name, Zeman. Just last Monday, he gave a speech he was in Washington, D.C., he gave a speech in Washington, D.C. to the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, to an APAC conference. In that speech, he urged the global community to show solidarity with the Jewish people and Israel. Well, of course, the government of Germany does the same thing. So, you know, I can't say I can't make that much out of this. But he said, now we all must say, I am a Jew. He told the packed auditorium of all these Jews, you know, and of course they loved it. They're applauding. And he says, and then he said it in Hebrew. And he says, of course, your discrimination is our discrimination. Your victims are our victims. You see the solidarity there between the Jews and the Czechs, and it also goes for the Poles, against any who would have any whiff still on them of Nazism, of anything reflecting back to the Third Reich, which is completely unacceptable. They are the perpetrators, let's remember. They are the perpetrators, and they cannot be the victims. So then I came across a recent article about this. Someone sent me from the Wall Street Journal, and the title of it is Controversial German Expellees Group Takes New Tack. And this is really pretty sickening because they got, as I said in the beginning, they got this new president, Erika Steinbach, stepped down. She probably wanted to because she's been in there a long time. And she was talking about stepping down several years ago, as I recall, but she just did it last November. And the organization, she had a lot of supporters in the organization, and then she had those who didn't support her so much, but they knew that she was working hard for their interests, but it was the Poles who were continually complaining about her. They just hated her. And so this article was written by Andrea Thomas for the Wall Street Journal, and she says, once again, as the world celebrates the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II, some Germans are casting a fresh look at an often forgotten consequence of the conflict. During and after the war, some 13 million, see they used the number 13, ethnic Germans were deported from their ancestral homes in Central and Eastern Europe to an uncertain future in their shrunken country. The issue still reverberates. Over the weekend, a group representing Germans forced out of the region known as the Sudeten, now part of the Czech Republic, formally dropped their demands for the return of lands. They never did that all the way up until now, just a week ago. They finally did that. And they did that because that's the new president program. She writes, now the expellees' main lobby group, which over decades has acquired a reputation as a bastion of nationalist and arch-conservative views, is trying to refashion itself as a voice for other refugees at a time when fast-rising immigration and a sharp increase in the number of asylum seekers has unleashed a backlash in Germany. Whoa, what to make of this? You know, now this group that has been speaking out for German interests of these ethnic Germans from the East is now going to speak out and take up the case for asylum seekers to Germany. And who are these people? These are people, foreign people from all over the place. Well, they're right now, there's a lot of, I was calling them Bosnians, but they're not Bosnians. And now I can't think of the name of them again right away. They're those from one of those Balkan countries. And they're Africans and people from all kinds of places where that wars are going on. And they want to get out of their own country. And they want to come to Germany. And, of course, there's a resistance. And there should be a big resistance. But no, now this damned expellee group, under this new fellow, wants to take this position to make friends with everyone. He's his name is Bernd Fabritius. That's a he's from Romania. He's called a German Romanian, is that that's the way it's put. A German Romanian Fabritius must be a Romanian name, kind of Roman, Italian. His father must have been Romanian or had a Romanian name. And also, he's 49 years old, so he wasn't alive during that time. He was born 20 years later. He didn't experience any of that, so it doesn't have the same meaning for him. But, of course, time is going by, and you can't have, you're not going to have people who were living then to run the organization. As time goes on, you have to have the newer people who weren't born then. But he says, we are born bridge builders. He's a member of the Bavarian Christian Social Union. So he's kind of conservative, on the more conservative side. But he's been a member of this organization for a long time. He came to Germany in 1985, I think it was with his family. So they didn't leave it. They stayed there a long time. They finally didn't feel welcome or comfortable, and they moved. But they didn't have the difficult time of moving that the earlier ones did. They weren't terrorized in that way. And now he says so. One of the responsibilities of expellees and their descendants is to remind others that deportation is never and for no reason justified. Well, if deportation is never and for no reason justified, because these Germans didn't want to be deported, of course, I don't think they would have wanted to stay in that communist country under Soviet rule either, you know? But that means that their position is that it was wrong to deport the Jews. Of course, that's the position of most people today, that it was wrong for Germany, National Socialist Germany, to ever have deported the Jews. There's never a time to deport anyone. Well, that would mean it was wrong for Edward I to kick the Jews out of England. It was wrong for Queen Isabella of Spain to drive the Jews out of, to make the Jews leave there, and that all the other places where the Jews have been. So I don't go along with that at all. And in January, he spoke out against the weekly anti-Islam street rallies. That's the Pegida. They don't mention the name of it. But he spoke out against the Pegida rallies beginning in January that started last October, actually. And he says, the Federation stands with particular empathy by the victims who are coming to Germany after fleeing or being deported. And he says, the German expellees and refugees are painfully aware of what it means to be forced out of one's home. So if I were in that expellee organization, And he's saying that this federation, this organization stands by the victims who are coming to Germany after being deported or fleeing their homelands. I wouldn't want him saying that on my behalf. But now he's the president, so I guess he thinks he can. Here now, the writer of this article goes on to say, after losing World War II, Germany ceded its easternmost territories to Poland and the Soviet Union under an agreement. Ha, ha, ha. You know, with the Allied powers in 1945 and 1946. Germany didn't agree to cede its territories to Poland and the Soviet Union. They were beaten in the war. They were driven back into Germany, and that was just taken. That's so ridiculous. And then it says that as newcomers and also reminders of Hitler's war of aggression, the expellees weren't always welcome. Well, they were all these ethnic Germans came flooding. You know, we're talking about 12 million by then. Some of them died, but on the way. But they came flooding into Germany, which is true, was shrunk and was decimated and devastated and so on. And so there was not enough room. There's no place for them to be. They were put in all kinds of strange, horrible camps were created and old barracks and so on. And life was really terrible for them. And the Germans who were there felt like, God, we can't get along already, and now we've got all these people here. So, yeah, it was difficult, very difficult, and the feelings weren't always very loving and friendly. But they blame Hitler's war of aggression on it. They don't blame anything else, you know. And they say that the Germans who were there were reminded of Hitler's war of aggression by these expellees, and that's not the way it was. Only the people who were always against Hitler, but most of the people were not, and so this was not the way it was, but this is what they want. This is the way they want to portray it here. Then they say commemorations of the deportations, while often low-key, well, they wanted to commemorate things, year after year on their own, but they kept them low-key because they drew suspicion in mainstream Germany. Well, what was mainstream Germany? Jew-dominated Germany and communist-leftist dominated Germany. So they didn't want any of this. So that's who they mean by mainstream Germany. Most Germans wouldn't have minded it. Always they come up with the Nazi crime stuff. So they sought to play down Nazi crimes, these expellee commemorations. When they founded their federation in 1958, the one they have now, the members sought to keep alive the refugees' old regional identities. That was one thing. Their traditions that they had there, their cultures, and, you know, probably even the clothing and the dress that they wore. And when they had their commemorations, they would all dress up and all this to remember it, to keep it alive, for in their minds they didn't want to give it up, and to document the history of their exile. And they also advocated for the rights of Germans in their lost territories. At the extreme, some of them called for return of property. See, they weren't all. It was controversial to call for a return of property because the German government didn't support it. But a lot of the people wouldn't give that up because they knew that they had been mistreated, and they didn't know that they had anything wrong that they had done. And so they wanted justice, but some of them gave that up earlier. Well, now they say here, they're talking about how the critics of this organization and these people keep playing on, again it comes up, keep playing on the fact that they say that 10, they've discovered in this study, that 10 of the Federation's founding 13 council members had a Nazi or SS past. Well, they're talking about the original ones back in 1945-46. Well, okay, 1953, all right. Well, is that unusual? Why wouldn't they have? Because they were a member, they were part of their government. And after the war, it was only those who were openly anti-Nazi at the time were acceptable after the war. If you went along with the majority of your country, and you're in the National Socialism, but you were seen as some kind of a criminal. And it was only the people who weren't, who were openly anti, like the Social Democrats, and not all of them were acceptable to be holding any offices and so on. And then they talk about Erika Steinbach, calling her the sharp-tongued conservative lawmaker, who led the Federation from 1998 to 2014 and courted controversy. Well, she didn't court it, but she got it because she said what she thought and she spoke the truth. She was among 13 lawmakers in 1991 who refused to recognize reunified Germany's new border with Poland. So there we go. It was in 1991 that, yes, with the reunification of the two countries, that Germany had to agree to recognize the current borders and not dispute them anymore. And Germany did do that, supposedly, in order to be able to reunify East and West Germany and have a more sovereign nation. Supposedly that created a sovereign Germany, which it still isn't, though. But Erika Steinbach was one of 13, only 13, who wouldn't do it, who wouldn't go along with it. Well, that's how hard-minded she is about this subject. This newspaper in Poland called Rzeczpospolita, I mentioned it once before. They ran a poll of polls, and she came in second behind Vladimir Putin in a list of figures who caused fear among Poles. That's very funny, but it actually was too bad because they were deathly afraid of her. They just couldn't work with her, they said. And so Mr. Fabritius, on the other hand, is very different from her. He's what I would call a wimp. He's, as I said, already gave you his age. He's less confrontational and moving to position the organization as a champion of human rights and a bridge to Germany's eastern neighbors. Well, so I say, will any of these eastern neighbors that they want to become so, get such good relations with, will they take in these refugees who want to come into Germany? And do these refugees even want to go to Poland or Czech Republic? They only want to go to Germany because that's where all the goodies are for them. So, this doesn't work out in a fair way at all. So why have all this concern about your neighbors? Fabritius said, a quote, Ms. Steinbach made comments in the past that could have been misconstrued given the sensitivities that still exist in Poland. Well, Poland is even more sensitive than the Czech Republic. They are the most sensitive people, and they always have been. And, I don't have time to say more about them. I want to talk about Fabritius. Not him or none of his relatives had experienced forced exile, but he has nurtured friendships in his former homeland, so he just wants to get along with everybody. There's another man here I like who's old. He's 74 now. Rudy Powelka. He's the former head of a lobby group for expellees from Silesia. He was up in Poland. And he says the Federation is betraying its purpose by what this Fabritius is doing, by backing away from issues such as land ownership. This is very bad, he says. He was expelled from Wrocław, which was Breslau, and now Poland's fourth largest city, with his family in February 1945. So early February 45, he was expelled and probably went through a pretty terrible time. And he would have been about 5 years old then. So he remembers it. And he has since filed reparation claims against Poland that are still pending. He's not giving up. He wants some reparation. If he can't have his property, he wants them to pay for it, like everybody else, like Germany has had to do for everything. He's a good man, but like I say, they're all up in age, and the new younger generation is not going to stand up to any of this. And then there's a man with a long Polish name who is being quoted at the end of this article. He's a history professor at the University of Wrocław, which used to be Breslau, and they're asking what he thinks. And he says that the former German regions of Wrocław and Silesia in Poland, had been Nazi strongholds, whatever that's supposed to mean. And the Federation, well, that's because these Germans lived there. And he's bringing up the Nazi issue again. He says that the Federation has long been viewed with skepticism in Poland. Well, gosh, I guess so, because of the suspicion that it sought to make the instigators of the war into victims. He says, I am skeptical whether such institutions still make any sense. Well, who is he? These are German institutions, and he is saying that they don't make any sense anymore, and they should get rid of them. Well, he's a Pole thinking about what's good for the Poles, and they don't like this organization, and they don't like being asked to give anything back. You know, it always goes that way, and they always end up with quotes from people like him in these articles. So to sum up, and I've got very little time left here, unless I go over just a little bit. That's it. I guess I will try to sum up, though, a little bit. That as I said in the beginning, the people who I agree with don't stand a chance here. And it's all time is running out, and people are passing on, and new generations are coming along, and they've been totally brainwashed, and there's no hope for it anyway, because if your own government, if your own nation doesn't stand behind you, you know, if Germany stood up for Germans of this type instead of Jews and left-wing globalists and so on, if they did that, then there would be some clout to it. People could get somewhere, but if your government doesn't stand behind you, and that government, in fact, is far more sympathetic with the foreign government than it is with its own people, which is the case, then you don't stand a chance. And we started out with the story of the rape, bringing this out into the open. You can do it all you want. She can write this book and so on. But it's not going to bring about any change. I don't see, I'm going to end on a very negative note here. I don't see the plight of wanting to have white nationalist countries, nationalist countries of your own type of people, ever being possible anymore. I don't see it being possible. I don't see anything being possible then. I see that it's gone too far and there's no sympathy for it. I was listening to, I had to go out today, so I'm a little bit tired tonight, but I had to be out a large part of the afternoon, and so in my car again, and I heard a few things on National Public Radio that just were so discouraging sounding. You know, the way they take all this for granted, that racism is so you just can't have it. It just can't be. I mean, there's some outrageous stuff that was being said, which at the moment I can't even bring to my mind. But just outrageous. And I thought, God, you know, I mean, I know that NPR is very bad, one of the worst, most extreme. But still in all, the whole thrust of all the talk everywhere and is racial mixing, racial mixing, racial mixing. Oh, this was about blacks. Oh, what was it? Oh, God, it was about... a medical program. They're trying to help. There's a new program for black people to, they were all blacks that they were talking to. It's not for black people, but that's where the money's going, and that's all the voices that I heard were that, you know, crises and bad experiences in your childhood, even before you're born, and after you're born and all the way through your childhood. Every bad experience that you have gives you a tendency for health problems, physical problems with your health later on. And so now they have this program. Oh, yeah, it's called ACE, A-C-E. And you can take tests. The doctors are supposed to ask these questions to their patients. And if they have these bad experiences in childhood, then you have to help them so that they don't become more ill, and you have to help them get over, you know, work through these things and so on. And look at how black families are. They were featuring this one couple. Now, this one man and his son, and he had been living with his mother. They were black, and the mother was, one time the mother slapped him and put fingernail marks on his face. And when that was seen, well, then it was reported, and she lost custody, and custody was given to the father, who had never had him at all up till then. And now the father is doing so well with him, but this boy is overweight, very badly overweight. So you see all the problems they have, and then he grew up with his mother, and so he had all of these difficulties. And we're going to fix this. You see, there's programs now, oh, we've got to fix this. Well, they're all going to be black, and who's going to pay for this? We're going to pay for it. Whoever's got any money, whoever makes any money is going to pay for all this. So what happens, as so many of you already know, somebody's calling me, but I don't think I have time to take the call. What happens is that white people are going to get tired of this, and there's no end to it. There's no end to spending our money for these non-white people who are allowed to be in our societies, and more coming into Europe all the time. We're not going to have our own children, less and less. So we won't be able to afford it. So who's going to make up these societies? I just see the writing on the wall, and I don't see anyone with the program or any suggestions. Because even if you have a good program, how do you get it started? It's just almost very, very impossible. Well, on that note, ladies and gentlemen, I'll just reiterate that the Germans are a conquered people. They are at least a conquered nation. 70 years ago, it took hold, and it's still going on. They haven't come out of it because their leaders are compromised and they don't want a strong German people. Nobody wants a strong German people. They just want a hard-working German people, I guess, until they're not able to do it anymore or whatever. But that's, there's nothing to be done here. I don't see anything to be done. So it looks to me like the German people are going to remain in this terrible state that they're in, and there's no way out of it. And that's something to consider, but there's no use in being hopeful when there's no grounds for hope. And I feel really, really horribly terrible about it. The only thing that I can see as a way out is just that I'm not going to live way into the future. So I'm not going to see it. I have to deal with all this because I don't see a future for what I would want and what a lot of white people would want. But there's so many white people today who feel totally comfortable with multiracial societies, and they're comfortable with it because they're not able to stand against it. They don't have the strength in them. They don't have the intelligence. They haven't studied the problem. They believe what they're told, and therefore they fit into it. And it's overall, it could be that the demise of the German race, I'll call it, is just the front runner of the demise of all of the European race. So with that terrible ending, I'm going to say goodnight and thank you for listening. I'm not sure I'm going to have a show next week, but I'm not retiring my show, but I need to get on to a pre-recorded podcast, and I just haven't done it. I need some time to do it. So I will say goodnight because I don't want to extend this program any further. Thanks again, and we'll be back soon.